The headlines. Dozens of European ex-officials condemn political interference in efforts by the International Criminal Court to probe alleged Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. Indigenous groups in Canada call for a nationwide search for mass graves at residential school sites after the discovery of the remains of 215 children. And Iran says its talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal with the remaining signatories will probably not conclude in the current round. Thanks for joining us. Dozens of senior figures have condemned efforts to obstruct an investigation by the International Criminal Court into Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. In an open letter, more than 50 European ex-officials decried and called for an end to political interference in the ICC's inquiry. In the letter, they said attempts to discredit the court and block its work cannot be tolerated. Top figures expressed concern over, quote, unwarranted public criticism of the ICC's probe into Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. They also lashed out at former U.S. President Donald Trump for imposing sanctions against ICC staff members and their families, a move later reversed by Trump's successor Joe Biden. The letter is also seen as a rebuke to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who last month criticized the ICC for investigating Israeli crimes. Lawyer and peace activist Barry Grossman says the U.S. and Israel do not accept the ICC's jurisdiction over the issue of probing Israeli crimes against Palestinians.
The United States has never submitted to the jurisdiction of the ICC. And certainly the occupation itself, otherwise known as Israel, argues, contests that it too is not really subject to the jurisdiction of the ICC. So there's no channel there on the face of it to complain about something amounting to an attempt to interfere with their processes. I think the response has to be a political one in the court of public opinion. And there can be no doubt that already for a number of years, there's been no end to the threats made by both Israel and the United States to the very existence of the ICC, to individuals working on the investigation of Israeli war crimes, and so on. In fact, it was made very clear that they would be lobbying all of their allies who are subject to the jurisdiction of the ICC to withdraw funding, and that they felt, that is both Israel and the United States, that they'd be able to shut it down. And of course, it's the only real forum out there.
International pressure is mounting on Israel as pro-Palestinian rallies continue around the globe. This was especially on display when a huge anti-Israel protest took place in Washington, D.C., which surely caught the attention of U.S. lawmakers and the U.S. President himself. The Israeli regime is now seeking a permanent ceasefire with resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. How costly has the 11-day war been for Israel?
Israel's war on Gaza ended over a week ago, but voices in condemnation of the regime's crimes against the Palestinian people are still being heard around the world. Pro-Palestinian activists from across the United States descended on the capital, Washington, D.C., to hold a rally. The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For us, we need to demand the following. One, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza. Let me repeat, immediate, unconditional lifting of the siege on Gaza, because that is what international law requires. Second, we need to hold Israel accountable in the International Criminal Court. Netanyahu is a criminal war, committed war crime. We need to take Israel to the International Criminal Court. Third, we need the implementation of the 4 Geneva Convention. Palestinians should be protected, not demonized.
It's definitely significant. There hasn't been a demonstration. It's not, they're not huge demonstrations. It's hundreds of people, but that's better than nothing at all. And it's not just in Washington. It's in New York, in Boston, in Michigan, Dearborn. There are, as you said, in London as well. So the visibility is there where it wasn't before on Palestinian issues. So this is really a change. And also there's now, it's quite acceptable for Congress and Senate to put forward bills to curb the so-called aid, the military gifts of $3 billion every year for Israel to destroy Palestinians.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause.
The pro-Palestine rally voiced demands that are hard to imagine for Israel to actually listen to, let alone abide by. One of them, the U.S. military aid to Israel, around $4 billion annually. Many demonstrators say that they will stand against any politician that continues to fund weapons to Israel. The demonstrators also wanted to send a clear message to the U.S. government that the days of supporting the Israeli regime without repercussions are over.
Israel's Foreign Minister, Gabi Ashkenazi, arrived in Egyptian capital Cairo on Sunday to discuss the May 21st truce. It marked the first formal visit by an Israeli foreign minister to Egypt in 13 years. Ashkenazi had earlier said he'd discuss what he called a permanent ceasefire with Egypt's officials. The truce was brokered and is being monitored by Egypt.
Just calling for a permanent ceasefire, it makes you want to laugh, because a ceasefire is a break in hostilities. A permanent ceasefire would be peace. So if what they're calling for is peace, well, then now you're going to have to get into how do you come about peace? You have to negotiate. And who are you going to negotiate with? Well, you have to negotiate with Hamas, because the PA has really no authority here. So the very first thing, before anything, you have to have elections. So somehow Israel's got to allow elections to go ahead. But they won't want to do that, because that will elect Hamas. But in any case, they're going to have to deal with Hamas on the ceasefire, because Hamas is the military power, the only resistance, active resistance. The PA is basically just a caretaker for Israel.
Palestinians have hailed their victory in the battle, citing their show of force to the Israeli regime by launching over 4,000 rockets and scores of drones to combat the enemy. Secretary General of the Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, has said the fight with Israel proved that Palestinians can overcome all challenges with a strong will. Nakhala added that for every Palestinian killed by Israel, the resistance will bomb Tel Aviv. The developments over the past month have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it would face grave consequences.
Indigenous groups in Canada are demanding a nationwide search for mass graves at former residential school sites. The group said that the government should also help research undocumented deaths and burials at the sites. Last week, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children was found at a former residential school in the state of British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, some as young as three. Canada forcibly sent more than 150,000 Indigenous children to residential schools between 1831 and 1996. A 2015 investigation documented abuse, malnutrition, and rape at the schools. The Pope called the system a cultural genocide for forcing kids to abandon their native language and to convert to Christianity. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has called the system a shameful reality of his country. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says the 2015 probe was quite right, called the assimilation system for Indigenous kids in Canada a cultural genocide.
There are reports that maybe as much as 25% of the kids that were brought into the residential school system actually died. So there is, unfortunately, probably many more burial sites on residential schools that exist in Canada, and maybe even burial sites that don't that aren't on residential schools. But, you know, the practice was in prisons and places like these residential schools that they would bury, you know, children or people in often in unmarked graves on the site. Actually, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission documented 3,100 missing children. There's been 900 more identified, and there are probably even thousands more when you look around the country and looking at the schools in Western Canada, Northern Ontario, and Northern Quebec, where there still is a large Indigenous population. But we attempted to assimilate them basically out of existence, and that's correct to term that as a form of cultural genocide. The federal Liberal government has promised to investigate the sites and put forward the money for this ground-penetrating radar so they can identify a lot of these children, hopefully bring closure to the families. But we destroyed the social and cultural basis for a lot of the natives, and we substituted, you know, alcohol, drugs, social welfare, and, you know, sniffing gasoline.
Colombian demonstrators have once again clashed with security forces as the country undergoes a second month of anti-government protests. Police fired tear gas at protesters in Facatativa, a municipality near the capital, Bogota. Clashes erupted while protesters were attending the funeral of an indigenous man who was reportedly killed during a previous demonstration. Anger is growing against the social and economic policies of the government of President Iván Duque. The demonstrations began in April over a proposed tax increase. The government later withdrew the plan, but the protests grew wider against police violence, poverty, and health crisis. Dozens of people have been killed since then. The UN has called for an independent probe into the deadly unrest in the South American country. Iran says the talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal aimed at reviving the accord will probably not conclude in the current round. Iran's top negotiator described the talks as complicated, adding that negotiations have reached the main issues of dispute. Abbas Araghchi noted that progress has been made in the talks, but delegations might need to return to their capitals for consultations. The current round of talks on the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, had previously been hailed as the final round. Tehran says it will return to compliance with the accord after verifiable removal of all sanctions the U.S. has imposed on the country since pulling out of the deal in 2018. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the latest report by the UN nuclear watchdog confirms Tehran's move to limit the agency's monitoring of its nuclear work. Qasem Gharibabadi said the report shows the agency has not been able to monitor Iran's nuclear work beyond its safeguards agreements with Tehran under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Gharibabadi added that the IAEA's report on Iran's enriched uranium stockpile is merely based on an assessment. Iran's decision to limit the agency's monitoring activities followed the December parliamentary law that asked the government to withdraw from the additional protocol and scale back nuclear-related commitments. That is in response to the U.S. pullout of the 2015 nuclear deal and its anti-Iran sanctions. The IAEA report has estimated that Tehran's enriched uranium stockpile is around 16 times the limit laid out in the nuclear deal. Homolensky says the latest IAEA report to its board of governors shows the impact of the agency's complementary access to Iranian nuclear sites being restricted.
The Iranian ambassador to the agency, Mr. Qasem Gharibabadi, and he said that the information given in this report, first of all, you mentioned that the stockpile of Iran's enriched uranium, based on the media reports we're getting, the number being mentioned more than, around 3,241 kilograms, which of course is way more than the limit that was set in the JCPOA, is, according to Iran and also acknowledged by the agency, is just an estimate. Because, as you said, because of this law that was passed by the Iranian parliament, the IAEA has had restricted access. And what Mr. Gharibabadi is saying in his response is that the level of access that the agency currently has is only based on the comprehensive safeguards agreement that Iran has with the agency, and it doesn't go beyond that. So any access that the agency had to Iran when it came to verifying and monitoring Iran's implementation of the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement and the restrictions set under that, and any access that the agency has had based on the voluntary transparency measures that Iran was implementing, including complementary access given under the additional protocol, or other accesses and other information that Iran provided to the agency and based on other voluntary and transparency measures that it signed up to under the JCPOA, have now been halted.
Campaigning for Iran's 13th presidential election is gaining momentum as the candidates appear on TV and radio to present their plans to the people. Our correspondent Humen Abedi has the latest.
The IRIB, the Broadcasting Organization of Iran, the red carpet treatment is being given to the candidates who want to contest in 13th presidential election. Several studios are hosting the seven runners who explain in detail their plans.
The economy under my administration will focus on domestic production and exports. Whatever creates obstacles on that path has to be removed, and whatever strengthens that sector must be paid attention to and boosted. One of my administration's approaches will be to use a strong foreign policy to create international markets to improve our domestic production and exports. We can make the best of the demands in countries in South America, Africa, and South Asia to achieve that end.
Zakani stressed that the next administration has to change course and rely on Iran's domestic capabilities and utilize all regional and international capacities to move towards success. The other candidate, Saeed Jalili, said Iran must not await favors from those who murdered Iranian anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani. He also added that a wrong approach and a weak performance cannot take the country to the summits. Mohsen Rezaei also took the floor to talk to the people regarding his economic agenda.
Some people misunderstood my plans about boosting the national currency. I said we can increase the value of our currency to become the third strongest money in the region after the US dollar and euro. It means that when you go to the exchange market after the first two, Iran's rial would be exchanged the most.
Rezaei also called for reforms in Iran's insurance, banking, and stock market systems. Reformist Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who was speaking at a news network, said that the main problems of the country today are due to macro policies, and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Humen Abedi, Tehran.
And that is World News. That's bye-bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's view on death. If you remember, we discussed the issue of death in different religions. Death is sometimes used for body and sometimes for the soul and spirit. When it is used for body, it means that the body has lost the ability of any movement. But when death is used for the spirit, it means transferring from one phase to another. It means the separation of body from spirit. According to the ayahs of the Noble Quran, the angels do not take the soul of human beings. In the same way, they take the soul of some people with respect and ease, while take the soul of others very harshly. The Noble Quran says in Ayah 32 of Surah Nahl, "Those whom the angels take away while they are pure, they say, 'Peace be to you,' enter paradise because of what you used to do." Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Death for a faithful is like smelling good smell, which causes him to go to light sleep, and all pains will leave him." In view of Islam, the best kind of death is martyrdom, meaning dying in the way of God. In Ayah 154 of Surah Baqarah, God says, "And do not call those who were killed in Allah's way dead. Rather, they're living, but you do not understand." It says emphatically that those who are killed in the way of God should not be called dead. According to the Noble Quran and the words of the Prophet and his infallible successors, most of the human beings are not able to sense the realities of the unseen world due to barriers or curtains that have covered their soul. The righteous welcome death as they know what awaits them in the hereafter. But sinners are scared of death, and when they near death, they think of repentance while it is useless. The Noble Quran says that the repentance will not be accepted. Ayah 18 of Surah Nisa reads, "But repentance is not for those who go on committing misdeeds. When death approaches any of them, he says, 'I repent now.' Nor is it for those die while they are faithless. For such we have prepared a painful punishment." God says elsewhere in the Quran that the Pharaoh repented at the time of being drowned in the sea, but God didn't accept his repentance. Islam says that the real owner of everything, including human soul, is God. And whatever he gives us has in fact been entrusted to us. That's why the religious leaders never lose their patience in the time of sorrow and demise of their near and dear ones. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said in a message to his companion, Ma'az ibn Jabal, who was impatient and restless at the death of his son, I have heard of your restlessness for your son, whose death God has ordained. Indeed, your son was a sweet gift of God, and one of his trust with you. He made you enjoy him for a while, and at the time that had been determined, he took it away. So, indeed, we belong to Allah, and to him do we indeed return. The Prophet soothed Ma'az's heart with these words. Imam Khomeini, as a true student of the Prophet's school, was a top example of patience in the way of Allah. When he lost his elder son, Haj Agha Mustafa, due to the conspiracy of the Pahlavi regime in a mysterious operation, he didn't even cry in public, although his son was a noted scholar at Islamic seminaries. One of the companions of Imam Khomeini relates his memory of those days. I never saw a drop of the Imam's tear for his elder son, Haj Agha Mustafa. He recited the ayah, Indeed we belong to Allah, and to him do we indeed return, and said, Mustafa was the hope for the future of Islam, and we lost him. Moreover, when he went to the tomb of his son for the first time, he was firm as a mountain and behaved very normally. This is while everyone was crying and weeping. He came in among the row of the attendees and asked very solemnly, Where is Mustafa's tomb? Then he sat at the tomb, recited Fatiha, and dealt with the issue very normally, and then returned. Dear listeners, although Imam Khomeini was very patient at the death of his son, he would be very sad and cry intensively at the martyrdom anniversary of the Prophet and the infallible Imams. This would surprise those who had seen the Imam at the death of his dear son. Late Haj Isa, one of the servants of the Imam's house, said, Unlike the patience of Imam at the news of martyrdom of his dear ones, he would weep very much at the ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Mr. Kosari would elegize, and the Imam would become very impressed and would sit down crying intensively. He also said, at the time of martyrdom of Agha Mustafa, the Imam didn't cry and restrained his sorrow. The people around him decided to elegize. But the more the elegies read out, the Imam didn't move at all. But as soon as the elegy for Imam Hussein began, he started weeping.
The debate.
News has emerged that the U.S. used Denmark's Secret Service to spy on top European officials, including the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her then-Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier. Even though the U.S. would not admit to this, didn't the former intel contractor Edward Snowden reveal that the U.S. government was spying on its allies? Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at the depth of the U.S. spying and whether the U.S. was the only one that was spying on its allies and the reasons behind wanting to spy on its allies. First, let's cross on over to Paris. Chris Dunhand joins us. Well, Chris, tell us about this, the spying allegations, how true it is, and the countries that are involved in this.
Well, the French Europe Minister Clément Beaune reacted immediately by saying that if these allegations are proven to be true, it's a very serious matter and it must be investigated very seriously. Also, Germany reacted immediately by saying, by asking clarification, because there is alleged spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and former Minister Steinmeier. These are really top European politicians. The Denmark defense minister declined comments on these allegations, but he admitted that spying of allies is unacceptable. Now, the strange thing is that since the Edward Snowden affair in 2013, who revealed that the CIA and the National Security Agency, NSA, spied on its own citizens and also on its allies, apparently since 2013, nothing has changed. That's maybe one of the questions for the debate, because Snowden, as a famous whistleblower, he has been sanctioned himself because he has been threatened as a spy himself. He had to leave the country and to find shelter in Russia. So the Danish media revealed that the United States continued spying on its allies even after the revelations of Snowden. So this is a very serious matter. It's not proven yet. So the first reactions of top European ministers like Clément Beaune are rather strong, but it has to be seen how far they will go and how far they can go in finding proof for these very serious allegations.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Chris Dunhand from Paris. Let me bring in journalist and independent political analyst Geroy Coleman, who joins us also from Paris. Geroy Coleman, welcome. So what are we looking at over here, and what is your reaction? I mean, if we want to break it down, which we're going to get into, but the news initially reads Denmark's Secret Service helping the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, to spy on European leaders. It included the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and now President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. What's your reaction to that?
I think this needs to be understood in the Russian-German geopolitics and the U.S. role in that. We must understand that Denmark is a key player in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project between Germany and Russia. And this is something that the United States have been trying to sabotage for a very long time. And they've been putting pressure on various European countries to do that. In particular, France has been exerting a lot of pressure on the Germans to pull back. Germany is very much involved. They're very much in favor of going ahead with this project. And Denmark is a key player because in October of last year, the Danish Maritime Authority gave the go-ahead for the construction of Nord Stream 2. And again, in January of this year, construction started. So I think we need to sort of understand that that's the geopolitical context in which this revelation has been made. The revelation itself is not major. It has been known for a very long time that the U.S. spies on Europe. I mean, they spy on everyone, and they spy on their own politicians. They spy on their allies. In this, in the game of geopolitics, there are no friends. There are just interests, and major interests here, of course, are billions of dollars in energy contracts, and that is really, I think, the context in which this, in my opinion, in which this story is sort of breaking right now. Denmark has been forced of quite a lot of controversy recently, also with the migration crisis, where they stopped migration flow into Denmark, and that created a lot of controversy as well. So that could also be linked, of course, because there's a lot of politics around the management of this of the migration crisis. But to come back to the oil pipeline crisis, I do think that that is the center, the key issue here behind this espionage revelation.
Okay. Let's bring in Mike Harris. He's an editor at Veterans Today who joins us. Mike Harris, welcome. So I don't know if you heard what our guest there said. I'd like to find out from you, first of all, the general conception or the general understanding of spying is that everyone spies on each other. I don't think I should say the U.S. takes the lead on that, but does it? And is it also true that they all spy on each other? And of course, the immediate question is, why would allies want to spy, in this case, the U.S. on Germany, let's say?
Well, let's answer your question in three parts here. One is, that's what intelligence agencies do, is they spy. And they do this through bribery, human compromise, blackmail, in order to bend people to their will, in order to get them to do things that they normally would not do. They do this in an effort to direct policies that would be beneficial to the people of their own country, to change those policies so that they're beneficial to the U.S. or whoever the spying agency is. So that's the first question. And I'll quote, everybody familiar with the phrase from the Godfather, Don Corleone, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, which really was he quoted that from Sun Tzu. But the issue is that is the nature of intelligence agencies. That is what they do. They spy on friends, allies, enemies, everyone is what they do. And domestically here, the U.S. intelligence agencies are spying on our own citizens, which is really quite unconstitutional and unfortunate for those of us who live under what is becoming a very authoritarian regime.
Okay.
Number two is no, the U.S. is not the most prolific spying country in the world. We're rivaled very closely by both Israel and China at this point in time. They're both been very, very active, internationally and domestically here in the U.S. So those are two of your questions there. So it's an unfortunate thing when they get caught at it. But as the previous guest had stated, there's a lot of money at stake. There's money on the table here, and it's pretty obvious to the entire world that the Biden administration is for sale.
Okay,
they're here to.
Mike Harris, I want to make sure that I understood the first part of what you said correctly, because I'm going to throw that onto our guest Gerard Coleman. And you said that spying is done in order to have countries do what, let's say, the U.S. wants, and to guide towards the U.S. goal in a particular, in a particular environment conducive to what the U.S. wants. Is that what you? Am I correct to understand you that way? That the countries spy on each other to get information to guide and push that particular country towards, let's say, a policy that the U.S. wants to enact, for example?
Yes, exactly. And we see the same thing in our country, that Israel does the same thing to us and our politicians. They're constantly spying and constantly blackmailing our politicians to bend us to their will.
Okay.
So this is pretty much a universally accepted way of doing business in the intelligence community.
Okay, Gerard Coleman, so do you agree with that? And can you give us examples, if you can, in the case of Nord Stream 2, if that applies, how it is that this is coming in that context, and whether the U.S. is going to be able to get Germany to follow what it wants, which is not to go with Russia on this?
Well, yes, I would agree with the fact that Israel is the key security threat to the United States because of the overwhelming control they have over the telecommunications industry and increasingly the internet. Just recently, there was a meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu and Lindsey Graham. And Lindsey Graham said, Senator Lindsey Graham, he said that more than Five Eyes, the Five Eyes, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, the official kind of spy alliance of the United States, Britain, and Australia, and New Zealand. He said more than the Five Eyes, Israel was the eyes of America, essentially. So they have, and they, of course, they sell that information to the Chinese, which is, to take up what your other guest said there. China's power very much depends on its ability to get information from Israel, and Israel has easy access. So,
there are no allies in this game, as far as I can see. There's just, you know, interests, and because of the interconnectivity between the corporate sector, big business, and intelligence, the military-industrial complex is so complex that it's very difficult to tell and to control information. One of the things that sort of comes out from this crisis again, and what emerges, becomes very clear, is that Europe has no sovereignty whatsoever, and any pretensions it has of defense, of mounting a defense policy, is ridiculous. It has been a project of the United States since the Second World War, and it continues to be, play second fiddle to the United States. So, the idea that, politicians are shocked by this, I just don't buy that. I think they've known this for a very long time, that, U.S. spies on them. But of course, as your guest said, French have spied on the Americans too. It's not anything new. The big question here is, why is Denmark in the middle of this?
Right.
No proof that Danish intelligence services have done anything untoward or have done anything that any other state has not done. I think the geopolitical issue I discussed there is probably the reason why there's a focus on blaming Denmark right now, because the Danes have given authority to Nord Stream. The European Union is against it, and I think now they're sort of ganging up on Denmark.
So, Mike Harris, why was the Danish government involved? Why did it decide to actually work with the NSA and proceed in what, like our guest there said, and what has been revealed, that it actually spied on many countries in Europe? So the question, in cooperation with the NSA, but why Denmark in this case?
Well, if you look at Denmark's strategic position here with the global fiber optic network, it puts them at a very easy access nexus there, where they can filter and take in information from both east and west, all of Europe, all of Russia, all of North and South America. Everything goes through a hub in Denmark, and that is why Denmark was a very, very logical insertion point for the spying to take place. That's really what the rub is there, is where can you get access to what's going on over the fiber, and Denmark was one of the places.
Okay, Jacques Wallman, let's take this a step further, the whole spying thing. It is reported that when there are, for example, UN meetings that take place, whether it's in New York or whether it's in Europe, that anywhere these countries and the representatives are, in terms of, let's say, the foreign ministers or the diplomats, they're being spied on, and they're being tapped, and they're being watched. And whatever intricacies are involved in their thoughts and in their policies, it's being listened to, extracted, and then there's a reaction. Are we looking at policies being changed, altered, and then presented based on the spying that takes place? Because if that's the case, then I don't know if you see where I'm going with this. There's going to be a whole series of events that could happen that would not be to the betterment of whatever cases may be presented. In this case, I use the example of the UN.
Well, I think that, we're in a situation where we're essentially living in a matrix, in an information matrix, where everything is being spied on. Every citizen is under surveillance. And that is increasing. I mean, as this scandal broke today in France, as they were discussing it, they're passing laws to put biometric identity cameras all over the place to make sure everybody's wearing a mask and to make sure everybody's doing what they're told, and further laws which enable them to track people on the internet to see what you're looking at, to see what and to listen in. This is happening almost by the week, that we have more and more violation of privacy. And so we are moving towards a world where essentially everyone, every citizen, is under total surveillance. And of course, that is going to affect our behavior, because we have to be careful about what we say, and you have to. So, if you're in, when it comes to state level, obviously, it poses a major problem, because again, there's a question of who has this access to this information, and how can a state have any sovereignty? But of course, the question of sovereignty
presupposes that there is such a thing as a nation. And we've seen the last 20, 30, last half century, that the nation has been one of the things that the oligarchs wanted to destroy. And so there really isn't any sovereignty left in these countries anyway. It's really just corporate interests and the interface of corporate and media and industrial interests. There really isn't any national interest left, in my view.
Well, the thing that's very perplexing here, Mike Harris, is the fact that when we take a look at Denmark, what has been reported is that the Danish foreign and finance ministries, for example, the Danish intelligence helped the U.S. spy agency, NSA, to spy on them. So basically, you're having the Danish spy on their own ministries. And then you also have a Danish intel ministry to help the U.S. spy on its different ministries, which then means that the U.S. is spying on itself. Doesn't quite make sense that you're having this Danish ministry spy not on its own country, but then having the U.S. spy on entities within the U.S.
Or any other government that there is. You have to look at it that there's a they're not a monolith. They don't all think in the same manner. You have different factions. You have different elements in there with it, which have different goals. Now, in the question of Denmark as to why their own intelligence agencies would be spying on other ministries, you have to ask why. You know, are they being leveraged? How are they being leveraged? And by whom and to what ends? Or are they in agreement with goals that the U.S. has that those ministries needed to be checked somehow? Maybe the intelligence folks didn't feel that the finance ministry was acting in the best interest of the Danish people. This is a complex issue that I have not had the time to do the analysis on, but there's always competing interests within any government, whether it's a U.S. government, whether it's a Danish government, whether it's a British, French, German, whatever, and they have different goals, and how they achieve those goals is really kind of up in the air, and this is a game of constant leverage, constant pressure as to how you can get other people to do your will, and that's really what the whole spying issue is about, is to getting people to do things they wouldn't normally want to do, but you leverage them by bribery, blackmail, human compromise, whatever, to make them do what it is you want for fear of being exposed for some other nefarious reason. But that is the business of what the intelligence agencies do. That's how they gain their power. That's how they exert their power, is through those vehicles of bribery, human compromise, and blackmail. That's what they do.
Okay, taking all those acts that our guest there, Mike Harris, said, Gerard Coleman, can you give us another example that, in essence, there's manipulation that happens based on the different acts that our guest there said? If you can give us an example, you talk about the Nord Stream. If there are any other ones of significance.
I didn't get the last big segment there, unfortunately.
Mike Harris talked about how it's being used as leverage, the information that's extracted through the spying. I'm asking whether you can give us another example, aside from what has happened with Nord Stream, of this being used as leverage or manipulated to obtain the goals of the certain countries who are doing this. Let's, for example, the U.S. or any other country you can give us an example of.
Well, threats, I presume your guest mentioned threats. You can threaten people with death, for example, or accidents can happen. I remember a few years ago, there was a helicopter accident Angela Merkel had. There was no official mention of a conspiracy to kill her, but it was a rather unusual helicopter accident, and they had to land and make an emergency landing. These are the kinds of things that can happen when a leader is not playing ball. Plane crashes have been known to happen. The French, for example, during the Cold War, got rid of many African leaders that way by organized plane crashes. So these are classic, I guess, these are classic assassination techniques. So, that can happen. And of course, you can have coups, color revolutions. Obviously, that's not going to happen in Germany because it's already playing ball on more social issues. So this is a much trickier dossier, I think, for the U.S., how to stop the pipeline project. I mentioned the role, of course, of engineered migration, which is where you escalate a migration crisis to put pressure on a state. And we saw examples of that 2016 crisis, where the Turkish leader Erdogan was leveraging the refugees and the migrants, and threatening the EU in order to get to gain, you know, bargaining power. So these are things, for example, I mentioned earlier that the Danes had already created controversy because they had closed borders to foreign migrants. I mean, that's something, you know, we could see that escalating perhaps in the next few months, where the Danes are under more pressure with far more migrants coming than they previously would have thought. So there are many examples of that, and there are, you know, these are the kind of tricks that intelligence agencies play all the time.
Thank you very much for that. We're going to unfortunately end the debate. We're fresh out of time. Krista Hahn, a correspondent, spoke at the top of the debate. Editor at Veterans Today, Mike Harris, thank you for your thoughts. And journalist and independent political analyst, Geoffroy Coleman, there from Paris. And that is it for this edition. Do join us for the next one. From Mika Batakwe, the entire team is goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: إن كلام الحكماء إذا كان صوابا كان دواء، وإذا كان خطأ كان داء.
Imam Ali stated, "When the utterance of the wise is to the point, it serves as a cure. But if it is wrong, it proves to be an illness." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the amazing things which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali is the fact that we must always remain steadfast in our religion, and we must make sure to put forth effort when it comes to our taqwa, our piety, our God consciousness. Now, of course, there is no doubt, and it has been